Even with the seal on my arm, it had taken me an hour to convince my father and Miranda to give me a mild sedative so I could sleep and return to those dreams. And then another hour, lying on my bed in the darkness while listening to their quiet, urgent voices in the living room, waiting for the sedative to calm me. The last time I knew, it was just after 9:30 p.m. in Eden. And then I was waking on horseback, slumped over, staring at the sand. The horse had come to a stop. Birds chirped above me. My cheek rested on the mare's mane. I jerked up, but leather tethers tied to my wrists prevented me from sitting straight.
"Easy now."
The distinctive low rumble behind me was Talia.
"You'll forgive me for securing you so you wouldn't fall off and crack your skull open on a rock. Just slip your wrists out."
I did so and looked around. We were at the edge of a small, clear lake with a forest to our rear, the first I'd seen since waking in the desert 2 days earlier. Mountains rose beyond the lake. Shafts of sunlight glanced off the mirrored surface. I had been sleeping all night and half the day. "What time is it?" I asked.
"Time?"
Talia slipped from his saddle and rubbed his stallion's neck.
"It is time to begin your training, I would say."
He looked up at me, eyes glinting with a mischievous light.
"Wouldn't you?"
Had he slept? I couldn't see how. He looked exactly as I'd last seen him, long white hair held off his face with two braids tied at the back, bushy eyebrows and smooth skin, no sign of fatigue, and no sign of his lion, Judah. He winked at me.
"Suffice it to say that I require less sleep than you. But yes."
He smoothed his beard.
"I do sleep, and I do eat, and right now I could use a good bath, but that will have to wait."
His comment made me think of where I was from, not only here in this world, but in my dreams. "I'm dreaming each night that I live in a place called Eden," I said.
"Yes, you are."
My pulse surged. He knew. A dozen questions bombarded me, but he spoke before I could form the first.
"You've entered a gateway that bridges two worlds through the books of history, which have been activated by your blood. Whatever you willingly write in it now will manifest."
"Vlad's book." His brow arched.
"He calls himself Vlad there?"
"Vlad Smith. Who is he?"
"He's from this world, sent to the other to wait for you, the 49th Mystic. The gateway in the books of history was closed and can only be opened by the blood of the 49th. He expects you to make a way."
"So I shouldn't write him in?"
"Inadvisable."
"Why didn't he show himself sooner? He's been stalking my dreams for a long time."
"Because you only became the 49th when you turned 21, just 3 days ago."
"I'm only 16 in my dreams."
"Regardless, 21 here. 3 sevens. His efforts begin now."
"What efforts?"
"As the 49th in fullness, now 21 years of age, you are chosen to represent all humanity in fullness. As such, you will once more bring the sword that divides fear from love in every human heart. If you succeed in awakening to love by finding the 5 seals of truth, the lion will lie down with the lamb in a return to innocence." He grinned and grunted softly. "Ironically, the Horde believes that if the lion lies down with the lamb, they will be forced to become albino. Most albinos believe it means they'll be enslaved by the Horde. Thus, you are enemy to both. Please, step down. It's time to begin."
"What about Vlad?"
"If the shadow of death can thwart you in either reality, you will fail in both realities. What happens to you in one reality, death, say, also happens in the other. Vlad is the one sent by Tile to foil you in the other reality, thus vastly improving his chances of stopping you here. But he isn't permitted to kill you by his own hand. His goal is to keep you from finding all 5 seals before the appointed time.
What appointed time? When?
Soon. Very soon. You will see.
He paused as my head spun.
You must understand, dear daughter, the seals are truth in both worlds. If you fail to find all 5 before that time, the prophecy of the 49th is vacated, and this world will be forever locked in blindness. Vlad will stop at nothing to keep you from finding all 5 seals. But your greatest antagonist is your own mind. My role is to help you. Only when you know all 5 seals can you possibly prevail in your mission to lead all from fear. Then, and only then, will the lion lie down with the lamb.
A beat.
Please, step down from your horse.
Hearing my mission so clearly laid out once again, I felt completely overwhelmed. I dismounted, muscles stiff, heart in my throat. So the fate of all depends on me?
You represent every human bound in polarity. We are one, symbolized by you, the 49th. The journey you take now will be the journey of all, sooner or later.
Polarity. Vlad had used the same term.
Yes, polarity, Talia said, as if hearing my thoughts. Like the poles, north and south, opposites.
He picked up a pebble, walked to the edge of the lake, and casually flicked the stone with his thumb. It plopped into the water and vanished beneath the surface.
The world of plus and minus, up and down, good and evil, love and fear. The laws that govern all you think you know. If you toss a stone in the water, it will sink. Gravity and such. Yes?
I stood beside my horse, watching him, 10 paces away. Yes.
The dimension of polarity.
He clasped his hands behind his back and faced me.
And it is in this dimension that you journey to recognize yourself beyond all those laws once more. Re, meaning once again, and cognize, meaning to know. To know once more, to align or to awaken. This is the summary of the 5 seals of truth. Believe me, awakening is an experience far too wondrous for the human mind to comprehend. It's the journey of all. You will lead them.
My head swam with his words. They seemed to carry a power beyond their form. His eyes were on my shoulder.
I see that you have encountered the first seal, he said softly. The light.
I glanced at my right arm. The bright white ring had joined the tattoo in this reality, as well as in Eden. Wonder flooded me. The first seal was now a part of me. The light, I heard myself say. We think there is some darkness in the light, but we're wrong. Origin is infinite.
With my uttering of those words, a great peace settled over me. The birds were still chirping above me, but as if in another dimension.
A perfect stillness, alive with its own energy, shut down all of my senses for a few seconds. Then I blinked, and the world around me came back into its familiar form. But even then, the air seemed to have changed. I slowly faced Talia, who was staring directly at me. A tear slipped down his cheek.
You see how powerful the truth is, daughter of Elion, he said. All fear is rooted in a failure to know Elion as infinitely complete, experiencing no fear, only love, because there is no fear in love.
Beyond polarity, I said.
In it, but not of it.
He dipped his head.
Well done. You will need the first three seals to save Eden. The fourth and fifth lead all beyond polarity. Against the fifth seal, there is no defense. Until you have all five, you are vulnerable to being blinded once more. His mention of blindness might have unnerved me, but I had the white seal on my arm and felt no fear in that moment. Talia stooped, plucked up another pebble, and tossed it into the lake. I still remember the day long ago when you drowned and emerged, healed of the scabbing disease. A red pool, much smaller than this lake. Justin's red waters saved you in the same way they save all who drown. Thus you were albino, like all albinos in the Order of Justin. He took a deep breath and let it out slowly. But albinos, unlike Justin, still have a problem. And so we come to the crux of the matter, dear 49th. Our problems here in polarity. I walked down the narrow shore and stared out at the water beside him, trying to remember my drowning. "Do you know what a water walker is?" he asked.
"Should I?"
"In mystic speak, a water walker is one who can overcome the laws that bind us to the world of polarity, both metaphorically, as in stepping beyond fear and walking on the troubled seas of this life, and at a higher level, materially, overcoming the physical laws of polarity." He wagged his chin at the lake. "Do you think it's possible?" "Stepping beyond fear? Or actually walking on water?" I stared at the lake's surface, perfectly calm. "In the end, they are the same. Is it possible?"
"I don't see how."
"The idea that you can't is only a story you've been led to believe. No more real than any other tall tale you've bound yourself to, thus making it so in your experience. Try it."
"Walk on water? It's water."
"And so you are mastered by this story you believe about yourself, that you will be a victim of the water. All live in one story or another, a victim of this or that." He looked down at me. "We can also change our story. Try it."
"But I..."
Talia stepped off the shore and walked into the lake. But then I saw that his feet weren't in the water. They were on it, as if the surface was made of soft glass. I blinked and looked closer, stunned by the slight bending of the water under his sandals. He turned, faced me with a mischievous glint in his eyes, and spread his arms. "This is the story I believe." I gawked at him.
"How?"
"Through a shift in perception, our entire lives change. It's the basis for all that is miraculous, the shifting of our perception of the material world beyond time and space. When you look at what's beneath me, what do you see?"
"Water,"
I said. "And can you walk on it?"
I looked at the shimmering water under his feet. "No."
"And so you are bound by that belief. Instead, look with new eyes. Change your cognitive perception, your thinking. Yeshua called this practice metanoia, as written in ancient Greek. Meta, which means change, or beyond, and noia, meaning thinking or knowing. Metanoia."
He made it sound so simple. But nothing about him standing there in that impossible place seemed simple to me. Just rewire my mind?
"Don't conform to the patterns of the world you see. Step off the shore of your old mind and into a new mind. Walk on water."
"I don't see how I can do that."
"Try it, and you will see how."
I stared at the water, feeling silly and way out of my depth. But he said, "Walk." heart hammering. I gingerly stepped forward. Cool water swallowed my feet and ankles. Then, with another step, my calves. But of course, I already knew I couldn't walk on water. Or not, Talia said, right brow arched over a slight grin. Have no fear. We only just begin. He walked past me, stepped onto the shore, and strode toward his horse. You see, 49th, it's as difficult for albinos to overcome the polarity of love and fear as it is for them to escape the polarity of gravity. They're still stuck in an old story about who they are and what the world is, and so remain victims of that story. He grabbed his reins and swung into his saddle, eyes on me. But one day, if you pay attention, you might believe a new story and walk on the troubled seas of this life. He paused. We ride. I sloshed out of the lake and hurried for my mount, mind buzzing. He was comparing overcoming fear with overcoming gravity, which I got. But how he could actually do it was beyond me. I mounted and drew my horse next to his as he took us into the trees. Still no sign of his lion, Judah. The problem of polarity, he boomed, spreading both arms wide to the world around us. This is the crux of the matter. Yes, 49th? My mind was churning through wild possibilities. Light and darkness, up and down, love and fear. And the greatest miracle is rising above the seas of fear rather than being pulled into them. This is the true power of a water walker. Yes? Yes, I breathed, caught up in his passion. He lifted a finger. All fear springs from an aversion to being threatened or wronged on some level, and yet it is written that true love holds no record of wrong. Love does not take wrong into account. There is no fear in love, no polarity. This is Elion's love, which sees no threat against itself because it is whole and cannot be disturbed or upset by any finite threat. My mind spun. It is further written that all confessions of faith, all knowledge, and all belief are nothing without a love that holds no record of wrong. Furthermore, those who follow the way will be known for such love. Do you know those who hold no record of wrong, 49th?
No.
Then softly, they would be like water walkers. And thus, the problem with albinos. Though saved in the next life, they cling to judgment, holding records of wrong, and thus subjecting themselves to what they believe threatens them. Without love that holds no record of wrong, they are as powerless as the Horde. Your journey is to find the vine of true love beyond judgment, then abide in it. In the end, this is the meaning of all five seals. A low hum of anxiety replaced my wonder. You're saying I should see no threat in Vlad? It's impossible to hold no record of wrong, even for a short time. And for that short time, you will find yourself a victim of fear and conflict, professing your beliefs, but compromised by grievance. Your beliefs are powerless to save you from worry and fear when you hold any record of wrong. True love holds no record of wrong. It's the only way you can walk on water. His words frustrated me because he was talking in esoteric terms, nothing concrete that I could wrap my brain around. It still doesn't make sense to me. You're saying no one knows how to love? He turned his head and drilled me with a penetrating stare. Origin, he said with absolute authority, is infinite. I stopped my horse, taken aback.
My father does.
Elion, he said, voice now soft. Does he not love you with the same love he asks you to love others with? If he were told to hold a record of wrong for even 1/1,000,000,000th of a second, then for that 1/1,000,000,000th of a second, he would be compromised, a victim threatened by what is finite. Do you think so little of him?
He might have hit me with a sledgehammer, and I would have felt less of an impact. Not because of the truth of his statement, but because I felt small for having so recently felt that overwhelming love in Eden, only to have already argued against it.
You must simply learn to see what he sees, to see with the eyes of love, to see with the eyes of Justin. This we call faith in Justin, the evidencing or manifestation of things unseen by the old mind. In this you can move mountains. In this you are a water walker.
I let his words settle, imagining a world in which no one held records of wrong. There would be no arguments, no division, no hard feelings of any kind. It would be heaven on earth, a true Garden of Eden.
What about the law?
I asked.
Like in the scriptures, it holds record of wrong, right?
The law is an old wineskin, he said, weak and useless, fear-based. A decent teacher at first, but that harsh schoolmaster can only lead you to true love by its failure to save you from fear. The more you try to follow the law, the more it fails. Indeed, the fulfillment of that old law is the new law called grace. Grace is found only in faith that surrenders to a love that holds no record of wrong. So we never condemn this world of polarity and law. We honor it for the lessons it brings us as we move beyond it.
With that one statement, a dozen confusing teachings from Eden shifted and came into focus. I was clearly mastered by the law, which caused all of my fear.
Any assessment of what's been written that doesn't lead to true love is simply a misunderstanding,
he said.
Powerless.
Because it takes you back into law,
I whispered.
And so you sink.
He nodded, and we started the horses forward again.
No need to condemn yourself, daughter. Your father doesn't accuse you. Your faith in the law is your accuser, as written.
My father didn't accuse me, and this had been written? Written where?
Talia turned his horse to face me and looked me in the eye.
My dear, everything I say has been written in the ancient texts, with which you are quite familiar.
You mentioned the scriptures yourself.
Everything I teach you is from the teachings of Yeshua, Yonin, and Paulus.
Simon had never taught them like this. He took a deep breath, and his horse resumed its walk.
The love that frees you from fear begins with knowing origin is infinite, not subject to fear. Few albinos truly know Elyon as infinite, beyond threat, much less who they are as the sons and daughters of Elyon. They look only to the life to come, while blind in this one.
Seeing they do not see,
I said.
Those were Justin's words.
He nodded once.
He too came with a sword to divide the old mind from the new. Grace and truth always cause havoc in the face of the laws of polarity.
I recalled the rest of Justin's words.
I would bring crisis,
but I didn't want to be someone who caused conflict. Nor did I feel remotely qualified to lead anyone anywhere. I couldn't even lead myself. If they expected me to hold no record of wrong, maybe God could do that. But me? My familiar friend, anxiety, drummed softly in the back of my mind.
Know that there's only one way to find true peace in this life. It is this forgotten way that Justin invites you into.
I remained silent as I considered his words. The five seals were that forgotten way. I wasn't sure I wanted to pursue it.
Who am I? I asked. My mother and father. The mystics.
He looked up at a blue jay fluttering between branches above us. There have been many mystics, but most have been killed. You'll meet those who still live in this world soon enough. Elianite authorities found your mother and father guilty of heresy and banished them to the wastelands when you were 3 years old. When you were found by our tribe, both had passed. The mystics raised you as their own. You were taken captive and traded to the Horde. Bael, servant of Chile, poisoned your mind and erased your memory as part of his customary practice.
You told Samuel that my name isn't Rochelle.
Because it isn't, and it is. A person's true name is their identity beyond their earthen vessel. The earthen vessel is only a mask they wear, though they believe it to be their identity. As you know who you truly are, you'll see that your name, your true identity, is in Christi. Daughter of Elion, the label of your earthen vessel is Rochelle. On occasion, I will call you by that label, but it's not who you are.
So my real name is in Christi, like Christi? But my earthen vessel is called Rochelle. This isn't clear to me at all. Why not just call me Christi, if that's my name?
In Christi, he corrected. This will become clear as well.
What if it doesn't? You said many mystics have been killed. What if I am?
Then there will be another 49th. He looked at me and winked. But I rather like this 49th. She is full of fear, just like the rest of the world, and yet doing so well. To this end, I serve you for a while before I leave you.
What do you mean, leave me? You just found me.
It will take us 5 more days to reach the Great Divide. Time enough for you to begin seeing with new eyes.
It was all too much, too quickly, like trying to drink from a fire hose.
We plunge into rivers of living water, my dear, not a little drinking fountain.
We'd come to the edge of the forest and faced another desert that butted up against the low mountain range I'd seen earlier. Talia's lion, Judah, rested on a low hill, watching us with lazy eyes. I assumed if there was any trouble nearby, he would be the first to warn us.
I presume Jacob stopped in the city for fresh horses and is already tracking us, so we travel with haste while we can. We train as we ride.
Talia faced the desert.
For the next 6 hours, you will follow close behind me in silence and observe. Your faith is currently in this world, as we both saw back at the lake. Now see with new eyes beyond the laws that limit you. To this end, I give you an ancient promise.
He whistled, and Judah rose, trotting east. What promise?
Patience, 49th.
He studied the wasteland before us.
It is said that in this desert, yellow flowers bloom every spring. The Rauch harvest them to feed their young. Look now. Do you see that harvest?
I saw only light brown sand and rock with a few tufts of grass and the occasional small shrub. No.
The promise I offer you is found in one of the most powerful teachings in all of history. In summary, you say 4 months until the harvest, but I say...
He lifted a finger, tapped his temple, and swept his hand across the desert vista.
Lift your eyes, change your perception, and in that perception, you will see a realm beyond time in which the harvest is already ripe, now, not in 4 months.
He called this realm the Kingdom of Heaven, also called Eternal Life. It's the experience of life, not bound by the laws of time and fear, up and down, cause and effect.
It is now, not in some future, as many suppose.
He turned bright eyes to me.
Do you know who taught this?
I shook my head.
Yeshua, Jesus, who taught obsessively about perception. It was he who also taught that the eye, perception, determines our bodily experience in this life. With clear perception, you see only light, unbound from the polarity of light and darkness. But if your perception isn't clear, you will see darkness, fear. So remove the plank of judgment that blinds you. Pluck out your eye if you must. It's better to be physically blind and perceive the kingdom beyond polarity than to have two eyes and be in darkness.
Oh, be careful, little eyes, what you see.
The song from Sunday school. I swallowed. An unfortunate distortion, he said. Yeshua's teachings on perception are a staggering invitation to see beauty instead of darkness, a shift in cognitive perception. Water walking. Metanoia, remember? Say it for me.
Metanoia, I said.
Good. There are two worlds to see in this plane of existence. In any given moment, you place your faith in one or the other, and are bound to it. Step beyond the polarity of time and space, and see what can't be seen with earthly eyes. Practice. 6 hours. Not a word.
He glanced at the trees behind us, patted the rump of his stallion, and took it into the desert. Leaves rustled, and I watched as Gabil glided down through the canopy. He landed on the back of Talia's horse, hopped around, and faced me.
That goes for you as well, Gabil, Talia said, as the Roush found his grip on the blanket behind the saddle. Not a word.
Gabil grinned at me like a child who'd been caught with his hand in the cookie jar.
Hello, daughter of Elion.
Gabil,
Talia warned, then to me.
Forgive my new friend. It's been a long time since any albino has seen him. He's quite excited about it all.
Gabil made a little salute with his wing, and contented himself with clinging rather precariously to the mount while keeping his big green eyes fixed on me. I found it hard to tear my stare away from his perpetual smile, but this wasn't the sight Talia wanted me to focus on. I had learned how to see without using my eyes, right? Having lived blind had its advantages. What if we were all born blind and didn't know it? I nudged my mount and followed 10 or 15 paces behind Talia, and I tried to practice what Talia called metanoia. I tried. For 2 hours I tried to see another world by changing my perspective through the shift of the mind Talia called metanoia. Problem was, I didn't really know how to lift my eyes and see that the harvest was already ripe. What was I supposed to do? Stare at the sand until my vision blurred? Close my eyes? Focus my thoughts on what was behind an object? In an object? The essence of the object? Polarity was the world of space and time governed by laws of physics, and quantum physics had proven over and over again that there was an accessible reality beyond space and time, the realm of the miraculous, beyond the law that most humans clung to. In the same way, polarity was also the realm of liking and not liking, threat and no threat, anger and judgment. Love, on the other hand, held no record of wrong. That was fine for God, who created all that was, and for Talia, who was clearly far greater than me, but I was trapped in polarity. This got me thinking about the Eden in my dreams of ancient Earth, where I was sleeping at this very moment while my father and Miranda were pacing and fretting over what might come next. I had to figure that out as well. Gabil calmed my nerves somewhat. His adorable stare was terribly distracting. And when he jumped off Talia's stallion and landed on the head of my mare, thoughts of anything but him were virtually impossible. The horse couldn't see or feel him, naturally, but I could, and I did, touching his wing and then his head.
Talia made no attempt to discourage him. I began to wonder if he was part of the test. He touched my hand with spindly fingers, then jumped behind me and rode with his wings wrapped around my belly. It had to be part of Talia's lesson, so I forced myself to focus once more on my surroundings. For 2 more hours I tried. Then for 2 more, before finally concluding that changing the perception of the brain couldn't be done using the brain itself. Hadn't my father taught me that? What was it Einstein had once said? A problem cannot be solved on the same level of consciousness that created it. Or something similar. If metanoia constituted a change in perception, then I needed more than a change in my brain's thinking pattern. I needed a whole new operating system. Clearly, I wasn't understanding his teaching because I was using a mind wired with old programming, and that frustrated me. Maybe that was his intention, to frustrate my old patterns of logic so I would let go of them. These were my thoughts when Talia finally stopped us to make camp on a high stone ledge that overlooked the vast desert we'd been crossing. The sun was on the western horizon, shifting from a blazing white ball to a fiery orange sphere.
"I'm begging your pardon, but I must be leaving now," Gabil said, jumping back on the horse's head to face me.
He gave me a respectful bow.
"It has been my greatest pleasure to ride with you, daughter of Elium."
I resisted the urge to give the furry Roush a hug.
"The pleasure was mine. Once I got past the distraction, that is."
"I distracted you?"
"Well, you are far too cute."
"Cuteness! And you are beautiful. But I have to fly back to my side of the woods now, or McCall might scold me."
He sprang from the mount, spread his wings, swooped low to catch some speed, and soared into the dusky sky.
"What did you see?"
Talia asked, as I watched Gabil quickly gain altitude, headed west. I faced him. "I saw that seeing the way you want me to see will require a whole new operating system." He gave no sign that he didn't understand what an operating system was. For all I knew, he did. The Utah of my dreams existed 2,000 years ago, and everything that had happened there would have been recorded in the books of history.
"So then," he said, "you saw only polarity."
"I guess so."
"And your failure to understand frustrates you?"
"Yes."
"Good."
"Good?"
"An excellent first step, especially for those who depend on their own logic."
Talia dropped to the ground and quickly untied the straps on one of his saddlebags. His comment frustrated me even more. "Didn't we all depend on our own logic? Why can't you just tell me what I need to know in terms I can understand?"
"Patience, 49th. Can a student write before they know the alphabet? In time you will understand."
"You speak in half riddles. Why can't you just tell me how to find the seals?"
"Half riddles?"
he said, brow raised.
"You mean like the half riddles Yeshua used to hide his meaning from those who didn't have ears to hear?"
"Parables."
And it was true. They were like riddles, hard to understand.
"When the student is ready, the teaching appears,"
he said, turning back to his mount.
"Seek, and you will find. The treasure is hidden for you to seek, not for me to give you. Only in that quest will you finally relinquish all that you think defines you to possess the staggering power of that which does define you. As Yeshua taught."
He withdrew a bundle from the saddlebag.
"Now, if you'll excuse me for a moment, I would enter ceremony. If you don't mind, find us a few sticks of wood to burn."
I watched as Talia hurried to the edge of the ledge, flapped open a thick wool blanket, swept his robe back, and sat cross-legged.
A few shrubs scattered about provided all the wood we would need, and I ambled about, gathering dried-out branches. But my eyes kept shifting to Talia. He gingerly unwrapped the bundle and withdrew what appeared to be one of several old books, which he laid on the ground before him. His back was to me, so I couldn't see the book, but I was sure it was a book of history. Pulse spiking, I dropped the wood and started toward him, but I'd taken only two steps before he lifted his hand to stop me. This without looking back at me, as if he had eyes in the back of his head. I hesitated, then collected the wood I'd spilled, all the while watching him. Judah sauntered back to our camp, took up a position close to me, yawned wide, and watched his master with me. Talia began to sway gently as he read aloud from the book spread out before him. I could barely hear his mumbling, only enough to know he wasn't speaking English. After 10 minutes he lifted his arms to the desert, now cast in an orange sunset, and cried out in a deep voice that seemed to shake the very air I was breathing.
In Christi is all. In Christi is in all.
Then again, louder,
In Christi is all. In Christi is in all. This is the forgotten way.
I saw that Judah's ears perked up and his jaw closed. When I looked back at Talia, he was on his feet, swaying and dancing in that long robe of his, doubling over and throwing his arms up, chanting with delight. The sight mesmerized me. He was like a grown child, oblivious to this world. Finally, he faced the desert, pressed his hands together as if to pray, and dipped his head to the vista before him as if bowing to an unseen master. Then he gathered up his book, returned it to the bundle with the others, carefully tied them back up in the protective leather wrapping, and strode back to me. He looked like a child who'd just experienced his first exhilarating ride on a roller coaster.
"Gather the sticks into a pile, daughter of Elion," he cried. "Tonight we feast by the fire."
Caught up in his joy, I quickly formed a pile, though I had no idea how to make a fire.
"Good enough,"
he said, spreading his blanket out on one side, then a second on the other side for me. He squatted on his heels, facing the wood. I folded my legs under me so I was seated across from him.
"You spoke of In Christi,"
I dared to say.
"In Christi is all. What do you mean?"
Without any spark that I could see, the wood burst into flame. Firelight shone in Talia's eyes. He winked at me.
"They are only ancient words that will be meaningless to you until you know them yourself."
"I don't know the words now."
He tossed something at me over the fire, and I caught it. A hairy red fruit of some kind, the size of a golf ball.
"Do you know the fruit?"
he asked. I turned it in my hands, trying to recall something, but nothing came.
"No."
"Then let me tell you about it. It's called rambutan. The skin is bitter. The flesh inside is translucent and sweet, wrapped around a large seed only good for planting. If you eat the sweet flesh, you won't dream. Which means as long as you eat this fruit, you won't awaken in the Eden of ancient Earth. You could go a whole year eating the fruit each night and not once dream. For all practical purposes, that ancient world would cease to exist for you."
Both the Rausch and Samuel had mentioned this fruit, the one Thomas of Hunter used to stop dreaming.
"Now,"
Talia stared over the flames as he squatted,
"do you know this fruit?"
I nodded.
"Yes."
"But you are wrong. You don't know this fruit. You only know about it. To know is to have intimate experience with, as a woman knows a man, to produce the fruit of a child. You may know about Elion, and commit your life to the infinite origin of all that is, but that doesn't mean you know Elion. When you know Elion, you will experience that realm called eternal life in this very moment, as Yeshua taught. Then you will produce the fruit of love that holds no record of wrong. This is your path.
I thought about my experience in Eden, finding that first seal. I had been knowing the truth of my Father, experiencing the infinite intimately. Wonder washed through me as I understood at least this much.
Now, once more, dear daughter, do you know this fruit?
No.
Good. In the same way, you can know about the seals, even their meaning. But until you know them, until you yourself experience their truth, they will remain powerless. Do you understand?
Yes.
Tonight you will taste this fruit. You will know it, so that you don't dream, as you will the next night, and the next.
He stared into the fire.
You must find the treasure in the field of this life through your own experience. Only then will you pay the price that costs you everything to gain peace and true love in this life.
His eyes met mine.
And you will need that power, because when you next awake in ancient earth, you will find yourself in a great darkness.
Chapter 15.
You think it's possible that she's right? Miranda asked.
David sat on the couch, tapping his right foot, a nervous tic he'd developed after his wife died, or was murdered. Which was it? He glanced at the clock on the wall, just past midnight. Thankfully, it was battery-powered. He didn't own a wristwatch. Without power, his iPhone would soon die. Candlelight from three small flames cast the room in a dim orange light. Rochelle had been asleep for over 2 hours and didn't appear to be having nightmares. At least, that much was good.
You mean the dreams? We've been over this.
Miranda stood from her chair and crossed to the kitchen.
Yes, but maybe we're thinking too small.
She put her hand on the pitcher of water and stopped.
What if Rochelle is somehow connecting with the fabric of reality, not as we know it, but beyond our understanding?
You mean spiritual reality? He said doubtfully.
I mean all reality. Like an oracle who's going to the beyond and bringing back the keys to truth. We could be sitting on one of the most extraordinary events in all of human history.
I think that's the job of science, not dreamers.
Miranda turned back. I don't think you're keeping an open mind, which surprises me. All of these years teaching Rochelle to believe in the impossible, but now you're unable to practice your own dogma.
Me? No open mind? You seriously expect me to believe a person can travel in their dreams? Because that's essentially what she says is happening.
She poured herself a cup of water.
Before seeing what happened in the sanctuary, I wouldn't have dreamed it was possible either.
So you actually believe her now? An hour ago you flatly dismissed it.
Miranda leaned back against the counter, cup in hand, staring absently over his head.
I'm not necessarily saying I believe her, but I do believe that she believes herself, and I do know what I saw.
An hour ago, you were adamant.
No, an hour ago, you were adamant, and I was agreeing.
She set the cup down without taking a drink and walked to the breakfast bar. Have you ever known anyone with a mind as reasonable as Rochelle's? He thought about that. She was only 16, a child still, one who'd suffered more than anyone else he knew in Eden. The black sheep in this paradise of theirs. Reasonable, yes, but still so young.
Listen to me, David. I know it's hard to see your own daughter as more than a little girl who's struggling to be typical. But trust me, she's far more than that.
Maybe. But I'll settle for typical.
Vlad Smith clearly has her on a pedestal. Why?
Vlad Smith is a predator who sees Eden as an opportunity ripe for the picking. Rochelle is only an object of convenience for him.
David heard himself saying it, but only part of him believed those words.
This is all about control for him. He's using her to make a point. Right in the freaking book already. It's a test.
But he has the same book she dreamed about.
He shook his head. Her dreams are fabrications, personifications of her hopes and fears. Like I said, Smith is testing us by using her.
If it's a test, I've never seen anyone as brave. She walked right up to him, took the book, and then refused him. But there has to be more to it.
There is no more. What more?
Why was he reacting so strongly? But he knew. If there was any validity to Rochelle's claims of this other world she was living in, everything he knew about reality was upside down. He couldn't accept that. And he was surprised that Miranda was now doing an about-face.
The point is, she said, walking around the breakfast bar,
her reaction to the book. Something happened to her. You can't deny that. It might as well have been an electric socket she plugged her hand into.
Psychosomatic, he shot back. The body does as the brain does because the body is part of the brain. What she believed manifested in her body. What do you think we've been slaving over all these years?
I know. Epigenetics. Placebo.
But so dramatically? You know the studies. Convince someone with an allergy to poison ivy that the cream in your hand is filled with poison ivy, and their arms break into a rash when it's applied, even though that cream is only hand lotion. You call that less dramatic than what happened to her?
She was blind. Miranda sat down, leaning forward. Blind, David. You know as well as I do that CRISPR didn't repair her sight. Nor did a placebo. Not all of her blood cells that quickly.
I don't know. Rapid, spontaneous healing isn't unheard of. So-called miracles happen more frequently than we realize. We're only just beginning to comprehend the power of the brain.
Granted. And if it was only her healing, I would be inclined to agree.
It's all related, Miranda. It's all about her dreams. I'll give you that. But it's her belief in those dreams that are affecting her. She's been tormented by them for years. Somewhere along the line they became an expansion of her reality. She no longer knows what's real and what's the dream.
David stood, paced to the window, and peered through the drawn curtains. Not a light to be seen. The room felt muggy without air conditioning, but he was reluctant to open a window. Not muggy enough for him to sweat. That was just nerves. He released the curtain and drew the back of his hand over his forehead.
Either way, her dreams are now the least of our problems. It's only a matter of time before they try to force her hand. We need to buy ourselves some time. If Barth was behind...
David caught himself. Miranda had already pointed out that his preoccupation with his wife's death was distorting his perception. And she was right. Best not go there now.
Maybe we should just take her now, he said. Get her up in the woods, where at least she'll be safe. Or out of the valley altogether.
We've been over this. The tunnel is sealed. We run and they come after us with a posse. Shoot on sight, remember? They were grasping for straws. The same straws they'd already drawn and discarded.
Then we take her straight to Simon first thing in the morning and settle this business once and for all. He's a reasonable man.
You mean settle the real business, which is confronting Barth about your wife's death?
I mean that all of this ties back to something Simon and Barth are keeping from us, and it's tied directly to why my wife was murdered and why Rochelle was born blind.
There. He'd just come out and said it.
Maybe, Miranda said, leaning back and crossing her arms.
She'd clearly forgotten about her cup of water.
But we can't let them force Rochelle's hand. We have no idea what will happen if she writes in that book.
He closed his eyes and drew a deep breath.
You really think it's all in her mind? She continued. That everything we've seen is just her body reacting to new neural connections in her brain. That we can't even consider the possibility she's not writing in the book because it really will have consequences?
He wanted to say yes. The alternative was far more difficult to explain or accept.
Miranda stood, grabbed his hand, and pulled him off his seat. Come here.
Where?
Just come with me.
She picked up one of the half-burned, tapered candles from the table and led him down the hall to Rochelle's room. Touching a finger to her lips for quiet, she opened the door and walked up to the bed. Rochelle lay on her side, head on one pillow and right leg thrown over a second. She'd pulled her long hair into a ponytail to keep it from her face while she slept. Cheeks amber in the candlelight, smooth as silk. A life lived mostly indoors had protected her from sun damage. To think something was actually happening to her at this very moment that would affect life here was incomprehensible, if not absurd. Miranda reached out and gently lifted her t-shirt sleeve. The white ring on her arm glowed faintly. The perfect circle seemed, by some optical illusion, to have depth. Impossible. But so was the tattoo itself.
Is this just the result of her beliefs, too? Miranda whispered.
If a poison ivy rash could manifest through belief, why not other discolorations on the skin? But David knew he didn't believe that either. Rochelle had called it a seal. The first seal.
She got this from touching the book, Miranda said quietly. Until you can come up with another explanation, I'm going to believe her.
A loud bang on the door to the kitchen shook the house. Miranda gasped and spun around, and David instinctively moved to put her behind him. The bang came again.
Wait here, he whispered.
He was halfway down the hall before he realized that she'd closed the door to Rochelle's room and was following. But his mind was on the banging, now accompanied by a voice demanding they open the door. Barth Caldwell. David had feared this scenario, but the fact that the man had the gall to demand an entrance in the middle of the night also infuriated him.
David!
Miranda was warning him, but he held up a hand, setting aside caution. They were defenseless here. Better face-to-face than in hiding now. He flipped the deadbolt, turned the handle, and pulled open the door. Light blinded him, and he jerked his hand up to shield his eyes. The light shifted, and David saw who'd come. Barth stood on the gravel, holding a military-grade flashlight. But he wasn't alone. Six of his joint forces, as he called them, stood by his side. The Glocks on their hips were holstered, but three of them also carried assault rifles. Barth glared from the shadows, in his element.
"What do you think this is?" David demanded. "Raid on Entebbe? It's the middle of the night, for heaven's sake."
"Wrong, David," Barth said. "It's the middle of a crisis. Or hadn't you realized? The Council requires your daughter. Now." He could sense Miranda behind him, and a part of him wanted to shove her back, slam the door, and take their chances. But the part that knew Barth had something to do with his wife's death resisted any move that could be seen as cowardice. "So a terrorist strolls into church and holds this town hostage, and you're going to give in to his demands,"
Is that it? David shot back. Wrong again, David. I'm giving in to my own demands, and my demands